just got word from the ratings group that we are the number one rated show on this station.
Who said?
Well, I kind of made that up.
We are the number one. You mean we get more listeners than anyone else?
Yeah, that's all it could mean, right?
Well, they're driving around in their cars.
That's why it's good to be on the drive
going
time
to work,
slot. Yeah.
Coming home.
Yeah.
You know, I listen to WJXC in the morning. I listen to Democracy Now.
Yeah.
And then I listen to Lincoln Mayorga.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just, you know, when I'm in the car, like you said, yeah, I just flip the channels now and then, and it's amazing, you know.
Yeah. It is. And keep us going here, folks. You know, we're making a new kind of constant request that you become sustaining members, because it makes it a lot, or supporting members. It makes it a lot easier, and will take the pressure off all these pledge drives we have to do. So if you can, yeah, as low as I, you know, I went on the site, Ellen, because I'm going to, instead of giving each pledge drive, I'm going to do like you're doing, give monthly.
Well, you know, it's kind of painless.
It's totally painless.
It works on your, it works through your credit card.
Right.
You have a chance at any time to change the amount you're giving every month, I believe.
Right. And it's as low as $5 a month. I mean, who can't afford that these days? It's a cup of coffee if you go to these fancy coffee places.
Enemies. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. We're on WGXC 90.7 FM, somewhere in the Hudson Valley. Hudson, Acre, Catskill, WGXC.org, and most of the rest of the world. It's the first day of September. Happy New Year. I feel like I hear a plane outside the window, which is a very strange sound around here. Doesn't sound like a muscle car, it sounds like a plane. Tonight, some recommendations. This is Lucia Berlin, not from her famous collection. But a posthumous publication called Old Evening in Paradise. And this is the title story. Sometimes years later, you look back and say that was the beginning of. Or we were so happy then, before, after. Or you think I'll be happy when, once I get, if we. Hernan knew he was happy now. The Oceanio Hotel was full. His three waiters were working at top speed. He wasn't the kind of man who worried about the future or dwelt on the past. He shooed the chicle-selling kids out of his bar with no thought of his own orphaned childhood on the streets, raking the beach, shining shoes. When he was 12, they had started construction on the Oceano. Hernan ran errands for the owner. He idolized Señor Morales, who wore a white suit and a Panama hat, jowls that matched the bags under his eyes. After Hernan's mother died, Señor Morales was the only person to call him by his name, Hernan. Not hey, kid. Andre, hijo, vete callejero. Buenos dias, Hernan. As the building progressed, Señor Morales had given him a steady job cleaning up after the workers. When the hotel was finished, he hired him to work in the kitchen, a room on the roof to live in. Other men would have hired experienced employees from other hotels. The chefs and desk clerk at the new Oceano were from Acapulco, but all of the other workers were illiterate street urchins, like Hernan. They're all proud to have a room, their own real room on the roof. Showers and toilets for the men and women workers. 30 years later, every one of the men still worked at the hotel. The laundresses and maids had all come from mountain towns like Chacala or El Tuito. The women stayed until they married or until they got too homesick. New ones are always fresh young girls from the hills. Socorro was from Chacala. The first day Hernan had seen her, she was standing in her doorway in a white dress, her braids plaited with pink satin ribbon. She hadn't put down her rope-tied bundle of belongings. She was turning the light on and off. He was amazed by her sweetness. They smiled at each other. They were both 15, and they both fell in love that very moment. The next day, Señor Morales saw Hernan watching Socorro in the kitchen. She's a little beauty, no? Yes, Hernan said, I'm going to marry her. He worked double shifts for 2 years until they could marry and move into a little house near the hotel. By the time their first daughter, Claudia, was born, he was an apprentice bartender. After Amalia was born, he was a regular bartender, and Socorro stopped working. Their second daughter, Amalia, was having her quinceañera party in 2 weeks. Señor Morales was godfather to both girls and was giving the party in the hotel. A bachelor, he seemed to love Socorro and the girls almost as much as Hernan, never tired of describing them to people. They are so fine, so beautiful, delicate and pure and proud and smart, strong, hardworking, Hernan would add. Dios mío, those women have hair tan pero tan brilloso. John Apple was at the bar, as usual, looking out at the malecón above the beach. Trucks and buses rumbled by on the cobblestones outside. John nursed his beer, muttering. Oh, you smell those nasty fumes? What a racket. It's all over now, Hernan. No more paradise. The end of our fishy little sleeping village. Hernan's English was very good, but he missed things, like John's remark. All he knew was that he'd been hearing it over and over for years. He ignored the sigh as John pretended again to drain his empty glass. Somebody else could buy him his next drink. Not the end, Hernan said. A new Puerto Vallarta. Dozens of luxury resorts were going up. The new highway was finished. The big airport just opened. Instead of one flight a week, there were 5 or 6 international flights a day. Hernan had no regrets about how peaceful the town used to be when this was the only good bar and he was the only one working in it. He liked having so many waiters to help. He was not even tired now when he got home. Could have dinner with Socorro, read the paper, talk a while. More and more people were coming in. Hernan sent Memo to the kitchen to get busboys to help out, to bring some extra chairs. Most of the guests at the hotel were reporters or cast and crew of the Night of the Iguana. Most of them were in the bar mingling with the inn people from town, local Mexicans and Americans. Tourists and honeymooners looked for Ava and Burton and Liz. In those days, one Mexican movie a week was shown on the plaza. There was no television, so the town wasn't impressed by the cast of the Night of the Iguana. Everybody knew who Elizabeth Taylor was, though. Her husband, Richard Burton, was in the movie. Hernan liked them, and he liked the director, John Huston. The old man was always respectful to Socorro and his daughters. He spoke Spanish to them and lifted his hat when he saw them in town. Socorro had her brother bring in Raicilla from the mountains near Chacala, moonshine mezcal for Señor Huston. Hernan kept it in a huge mayonnaise jar under the bar, tried to dole it out slowly, to cut it as often as possible without Senor Houston noticing. Mexican lawyers and bankers are trying out their English on the blonde ingenue, Sue Lyons. Ruby and Alma, two American divorcees, were flirting with cameramen. Both women were very wealthy, owned houses on cliffs above the water. They kept on thinking they'd find romance at the Oceano Bar. Ooh, look, there's some bar patrons outside the window right now. Sorry to editorialize. Usually they met married men on fishing trips, or now newsmen or cameramen. No man that would ever want to stay around. Alma was sweet and beautiful until late in the evening, when her eyes and mouth turned into bruises and her voice became a sob, like she just wished you'd hit her and leave. Ruby was close to 50, lifted and dyed and patched together. She was funny and fun, but after she drank a lot, she got mean and then limp, and then Hernan had someone take her home. John Apple went over to sit with them. Alma ordered him a double margarita. Luis and Victor stood at the entrance long enough to be noticed by everyone. They slid into the bar and sat down where they would be visible. Dark and handsome, they both wore tight pants, open white shirts, barefoot with a bright bracelet on one ankle, white smiles, wet black hair. Ratoncitos tiernos, tender little rats, whores, called the sexy young ones. Hernan was already working in the Oceano kitchen when he had first known them as children, begging from tourists, rolling drunks. They had originally come from Culiacan, called each other compa for compadre. For years, Luis and Victor had slept under petates in boats at night, hustled all day. Hernan understood them and didn't judge them, not even for stealing. The way they treated women didn't shock him. He judged the women, though. One day he had seen Victor approach Amalia on the Malecón. She was wearing the plaid skirt and white blouse from school, holding her books tightly against her new breasts. Hernan ran out from the bar and raced across the street. "Go home," he said to Amalia. To Victor he said, "If you speak to either of my daughters again, I will kill you." Hernan poured martinis into chilled glasses, put them on Memo's tray. He left the bar and went over to the young men. "Gibo, why does it make me so nervous seeing you two in my bar?"
"Cálmate, viejo. We've come to witness two historic events."
"Two? One must be Tony and the other Beto. What's with Beto?"
"He's coming to celebrate with the movie people. He got a part in the Night of the Iguana. Real money. Lana."
"Oh, me digas. Good for him. So now he's not just a beach boy. What's the part?"
"You're playing a beach boy."
"Watch him mess it up. I already know the other event. Tony's doing it to Ava Gardner."
"That's no event. Fíjate, there's the event."
A magnificent new Chris craft sprayed into the harbor, rocking the sunset-lit magenta water. Tony stood and waved, let go of the anchor of La Eva. A small boy in a rowboat went out to get him.
Híjola, she actually bought it for him?
"Title's in his name. She was waiting for him last night, naked in a hammock, had it taped to her titties. Guess what he did first?" "Went to see the boat." The three of them laughed as the beautiful, unsteady Ava came down the stairs, smiling at everyone. She sat alone in a booth waiting for Tony Hernan. Hernan was pleased that although everyone was looking at her and admiring her, nobody bothered her. "My customers have manners," he thought. Hernan went back to the bar, worked quickly to catch up. Pobrecita, she is shy and lonely. He hummed a tune from a Pedro Infante movie. Rich people cry too. Hernan watched like everyone else when the lovers kissed hello. Flashbulbs flickered like sparklers throughout the room. The Americans all knew her. The whole town loved Tony. He was about 19 now. He had streaks of blonde in his long hair and amber eyes and angelic smile. He'd always worked on the boats, unloading, loading, cadging rides, saving money for his own boat, someday to take tourists water skiing. Stories differed. Some people said it happened in a dice game. Others said he paid Diego cash to let him take the boat of movie stars to the set in Mis Maloya every day. After about 3 days of his golden eyes gazing into her green ones, she started taking boat rides with him on her breaks until, Tony said, fortune had smiled upon him. Memo said that Tony was the lowest. Excuse me. A gigolo. Look at him, Hernan said. He's in love. He won't hurt her. Across the room, Luis called out to an older American woman passing by the bar. Madame, please join us. I am Luis and this is Victor. Help us celebrate my birthday, he said. Why, I'd love to, she smiled, surprised. She ordered drinks and paid the waiter with a fistful of bills. She was laughing, pleased by their attention, took out all her purchases to show them. Luis had grown out of beach boying. He had a tiny dress shop that was the current rage. He sold colonial paintings and pre-Columbian art. No one knew where he got them or who made them. He taught yoga to American women, the same ones who bought all his dresses in every color. It was hard to tell if Luis loved women or hated them. He made them feel good. He got money from all of them one way or another. Memo asked Hernan if the women paid him to have sex with them. ¿Quién sabe? He suspected that Luis took them out, brought them home, and robbed them when they passed out. The women would be too embarrassed to tell. Hernan felt no compassion for the women. They asked for it, traveling alone, drinking, giving themselves to the first callejeros they met. Beto came in with Audrey, a hippie girl of about 15, silken blonde hair, the face of a goddess. Newsmen were popping flashes, and the blonde actress grew sullen. Audrey moved like honey. She had the blind eyes of a statue. Victor came up to the bar to talk to someone. Hernan asked him what Audrey was on. Second all, two and all, something like that. You don't sell to her, do you? No, anybody can get sleepers at the pharmacy. They keep her nice and quiet. Beto was sitting with the crew. They were toasting him, trying to speak Spanish. He smiled and drank. Beto always wore the stupid expression of someone on a bus that just got woken up. Señor Houston motioned to Hernan for I see ya. Hernan took the drink over himself, curious to know why the director was talking to Audrey so angrily. Señor Houston thanked Hernan, sent regards to his family. Then he told Hernan that Audrey was the daughter of a dear friend, a great stage actress. Audrey had run away from home last year. Imagine how her mother feels. Audrey was younger than both your daughters when she disappeared. Audrey pleaded with Senor Houston not to tell where she was. Beto loves me. Finally, somebody just loves me. And now Beto has a job. We can get an apartment. What drug are you on? I'm sleepy, you silly. We're having a baby. She rose and kissed the old man. Please, she said, and went to sit a little behind Beto, singing softly to herself. Senor Houston stood, stiffly knocking over his chair. He stood over Beto, began to speak, then shook his head and strode out of the bar. He crossed the street to the Malecón, where he sat smoking, looking at the water. Hernan noticed that the newsmen and women and the movie crew all knew Victor. Many stopped to talk with him. Victor went to the men's room often, before or after an American went in. He was the main marijuana connection in town and had a few discreet heroin customers. This was different. No one went out afterward for a stroll down the beach. Hernan had heard that it had come to Acapulco. Well, now Puerto Vallarta has its own cocaine, he thought. Sam Newman pulled up in a taxi, waved to Hernan as he went to the courtyard to register and have his bag sent up. He went over to Tony and Ava Gardner, hugged Tony, and kissed Ava's hand. He stopped at tables along his way to the bar, shaking hands, kissing the women he knew, checking out the new ones, who all visibly cheered up. He was a handsome, easygoing American, married to a wealthy older woman who kept him on a loose rein. They lived on the coast in Yalapa. Sam came to town every few weeks for supplies and a rest. Living in paradise wore him out, he said. Grinning, he sat on a bar stool, handed Hernan a bag of Juan Cruz's coffee. Thanks, Sam. Socorro was missing her coffee. Hernan mixed him a double Bacardi in Tehuacan. You come over on the Paladin? Yes, unfortunately. Packed with tourists. And John Langley, guess what he said? We're all in the same boat. He always says that. He's got a new one. We passed the movie set, and this lady grabbed him, his arm. Sir, she said, is that Miss Maloya? Langley removed her hand from his arm and said in that English snob way of his, Mr. Maloya, to you, madame. So besides Tony's boat, what's happening? Anand told him about Beto's movie career and about Audrey being a runaway and pregnant and on drugs. He invited Sam to Amalia's quinceanera. Of course, Sam would be there, he said. Hernan was pleased. Senor Houston is coming, too. He is a great man, a man of dignity. It's cool that you know that. I mean, without knowing that he really is a great man, a famous man. Alma came up, kissed Sam on the lips. John Apple moved back to the bar, and Sam bought him a double margarita. Luis and the American woman were leaving in a cab. Victor was sitting with some reporters. Hernan didn't know what to do about Victor. He would never have him arrested. Excuse me. But he didn't want him dealing in the Oceano. He would ask Socorro tonight. She always knew exactly what to do. Sam, take me over to meet Ava Gardner, please, Alma said. I want to invite her to stay at my house. She and Sam went and joined the enamored couple. On the way over, Sam stopped to talk to Victor. They nodded to one another, looking down while they spoke. Senor Houston came back inside and sat in his large booth. Richard and Liz arrived. Wherever they went, it was as if a grenade had been thrown through the window. Flashes exploded. People moaned and screamed and cried out, ah, ah. Chairs scraped and fell over. Glass shattered. Running footsteps. Running. The couple smiled all around and waved, like for a curtain call. Then sat with Senor Houston in the booth. Liz blew a kiss to Hernan. He was already fixing a tray with a double margarita for her. Agua de Tehuacan for Burton, who wasn't drinking. And I see you cut with plain tequila for the director. Some guacamole and salsa the way she liked it with plenty of garlic. She was cussing away. Hernan liked her. She was warm and bawdy. She and Burton had big booming laughs, were simply in it. Each other. The place. Life. Little by little, the bar emptied as people went to dress for dinner. They left walking or in one of the dozens of cabs outside the hotel. Victor went on foot with five or six men heading north to the bad part of town. Sam and Dalma took off in her jeep with Tony and Ava. Ruby, Beto, and Audrey were all fast asleep. John Apple offered to take them home in Ruby's car. Hernan knew John was thinking of her liquor cabinet and refrigerator. At least he was still in shape to drive. Memo and Raul helped him out to the car. Left in the bar were two old men, drinking Madero Brandy and big snifters. They set up a chessboard and began to play. A young honeymoon couple came in from a walk on the Malecón and asked for wine coolers. Hernan wiped down the bar and straightened and replaced bottles. Memo was already asleep, sitting up, as if at attention, on a chair by the kitchen. Hernan looked out at the sea and the palm trees, listening to Liz and Burton and John Houston. They were arguing, laughing, quoting lines from the movie or other movies, maybe. When he took them fresh drinks, Liz asked him if they were making too much noise. Oh, no, Hernan said. It is wonderful to hear people talk about their work when they love what they do. You are very fortunate. He sat down behind the bar with his feet up on a stool. Raul brought him café con leche and pan dulces. He dunked the pastries in the coffee while he read the paper. There would be some nice quiet hours now. Maybe later some people would have nightcaps before they went to bed. Then he'd walk home, not far, where Socorro would be waiting for him. They would have dinner together and talk about their days and their nights, their daughters. He'd tell her all the gossip. They would argue. She always defended the women. She felt sorry for Alma and Ruby with no one to protect them. He would tell her about Victor and her drugs. Even Sam had seemed to be talking about drugs with him. Socorro would rub Hernan's back when they got into bed. They would laugh about something. God, I am fortunate. He said it out loud. He was embarrassed and looked around. Nobody had heard him. He smiled and said, I'm very fortunate. Hernan, are you lonesome over there talking to yourself? Elizabeth Taylor called to him. I miss my wife. It's 4 more hours until I see her. They asked him to recommend a restaurant. He told them to go to the Italian place behind the church. Tourists never go. They think it's crazy to eat Italian food in Mexico, but it's quiet and good. They left, and then the honeymooners and chess players went upstairs. Raul slept opposite Memo outside the kitchen door. They looked like decorations, giant tourist puppets in their black boleros and red sashes and mustaches. Hernan was just about to fall asleep himself when a taxi door slammed. Luis got out with the American woman. She was falling down drunk. Pancho went to help him get her upstairs into her room. Luis didn't come back down. Several minutes later, there was the slam of another taxi door and a woman yelling, "You dickhead!" And then Ava Gardner came in wearing only one high-heeled shoe to her walk, so her walk made a hiccup sound when through the courtyard and up the stairs. The same taxi door slammed again, and Hernan was surprised to see Sam, with no shoes and no shirt. He had an enormous black eye, a cut, and a swollen lip. "Which one's her room?"
Top of stairs, second, Oceanside.
Sam went upstairs, changed his mind, and came back down, his hand out for the drink Hernan held for him. He spoke as if he had Novocaine in his mouth. His lip was so swollen.
"Hernan, you can't tell a soul. My reputation will be in shreds. You see a disgraced man before you, totally humiliated. I insulted her. Oh, God."
Another taxi, another slam. Tony came running in, tears streaming down his cheeks. He flew up the stairs and banged on her door. "Mi vida, mi sueño." Other doors opened all around. "Hush up, you fool. Shut up. Shut up!" Tony came downstairs. He embraced Sam and apologized and shook his hand. He cried in little gasps like a child. "Sam, go talk to her. You can explain. I don't speak English. Tell her how it's too dark. Explain to her, please."
"I don't know, Tony. She's really mad at me. Come on, you just go on in there and kiss her. Let her see those alligator tears." Hernan interrupted. "I don't know what went on, but I'll bet the lady won't even remember tomorrow what terrible thing happened tonight. Don't remind her." "Good thinking. Our man, Hernan." Sam went upstairs with Tony, opened Eva's door with a credit card, and gently pushed Tony into the room. He waited a little while, but Tony didn't come out. Sam stood in the cobblestone courtyard holding up his card, talking to an invisible camera. "Hi there, I'm Sam Newman, world traveler, bon vivant, man about town. I wouldn't go anywhere without my American Express card."
"Sam, ¿qué haces?"
"Nothing. Look, Hernan, you have to swear on my mother's grave. Come on, tell me all about it." "Well, God, we got to Alma's, and she tells the cook to make us dinner. We're out on the terrace drinking some more, music playing. Tony doesn't have a head for alcohol, and usually he never drinks. I had barely started, but those two women are wasted. It was dark. We're all sort of lying around on those waterbed couches, and she has when Alma takes Tony by the hand and, well, she drags him into her bedroom. Ava's just looking at the stars. I'm panicking, and then she notices they're gone. Sits up like a shot, hauls me off with her to find them.
Well, they're on Elmer's bed, naked, bawling away. I thought Ava might hit him with a blunt instrument, but no, she just smiles and leads me back to the terrace. Oh, Lord, how have I failed? I'm a disgrace. Sick. Right there in front of God and everybody, Ava Gardner herself steps out of her dress and lies back on the sofa. Oh, Lord, help me, my friend. That woman is magnificent. She is the color of butterscotch pudding all over. Her breasts are heaven here on earth. Her legs, man, she is the fucking Duchess of Alba. No, she's the barefoot Contessa. So I tear off my clothes and lie down with her. There she is, Ava, warm, in the flesh, looking into my eyes with those green ones. I know. My dick disappeared. It went to Tijuana. My balls took off for Ohio. And this countess, this goddess, she did everything possible. It was hopeless. I was dying of shame. I apologized. No fuck like an idiot, I said. Gee, I'm sorry. It's that I've been madly in love with you ever since I was a little kid. She's the one who hit me in the lip. Then Tony shows up and really starts beating the shit out of me. Just then the damn cook comes in, turns on the light, and says, dinner's served. I gave the cook some money and asked her to go find me a taxi, put my pants on, ran outside. Cook came back with a cab. I got in. Then Ava got in after me. Tony's running down the street behind us, but she wouldn't let the guy stop. Ava Gardner. I could shoot myself. Tony ran lightly down the steps and up to the bar. She forgives me. She loves me. She's sleeping now. Shall we go back for dinner? Sam grinned. Tony was offended. Then after a while, he said he was, in fact, dying of hunger. Memo had been awake, taking everything in. He said he was hungry, too. They should go in the kitchen and fix breakfast. Victor arrived alone, sat at a far table in the now dim light. Raul took him hot chocolate and pan dulces. Victor never drank or took drugs. Hernan believed he must be very rich by now. Raul told Victor that Luis was still upstairs. I'll wait, he said. Memo came out of the kitchen just as a few people came in for after-dinner drinks. Tony went over to wait for Luis and Victor. Tony had chocolate, too, and Hernan sent him over some aspirins. Tony didn't mention the evening to Victor, just talked about his new boat. Sam came to the bar and ordered a Kahlua with brandy. He held his head between his hands. Hernan handed him the drink and said, "You need aspirin, too." Luis came downstairs, carrying one of the woman's shopping bags. The three friends spoke in whispers, laughing like teenage boys. They left, loped effortlessly past the open windows out of the bar, their laughter trailing back with the sound of the waves, easy and innocent. What was that clicking sound, maracas? Teeth. Luis took the woman's false teeth. Hernan picked up Sam's empty glass and carefully wiped the circle where it had been. It's time for me to go home. Want some ice for that lip? No, it's okay. Thanks. Good night, Hernan. Good night, Sam. Hasta mañana. Well, there you have it. Evening in Paradise. More stories by Lucia Berlin. Posthumously feted darling of Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, circa the mid-20-teens. ¿Qué hora estamos? Wow. Okay. I'm going to read a story by a friend of mine. An old friend. He doesn't live around here. I guess he still lives in the city. Thaddeus Rutkowski's book, Safe Colors, is a novel and short fictions. I think it just came out. Oh, it came out 2023 as a copyright, but I think the book just came out on, I think the book just came out, New Meridian Press, part of the nonprofit organization New Meridian Arts. Safe Colors, a novel and short fictions. I think it's kind of a memoir, but here we go. Angry God. I could hear my parents arguing. We'd finished supper, and I was sitting between them and the TV set. My brother and sister were watching a show, and I was doing my homework on the couch arm. The show was about a train stop off the main line where three young women used a water tower as a bathtub. During the opening credits, their undergarments were hanging over the edge of the giant tank. The theme song promised curves on the railroad, on the rail track, and even more curves at the train's destinations. Now and then my parents' voices came over the sound of the television. God is angry with me, my father said. I must have done something wrong. It must have been having a family. I can't take care of a family. I'm supposed to make art. Don't talk to me about religion, my mother said. I'm the daughter of a Chinese minister. An angry God makes me angry. Why can't I have a long stride like the stride of the God who stomps out nations? The foolishness of God is greater than man's wisdom. Don't quote the Bible to me. I'm keeping it away from my children. The devil's talking to me now. Sorry, I wasn't prepared to turn that page. I'm going to mark the page about wisdom with a gold tassel. On the TV, the mother was warning her three daughters about danger around the bend. A train crew might sneak in and drain the water tower, leaving the women bare. I'm not taking my kids to church, my father said. They're not going to be Americans. Are they going to be Chinese? My mother asked. Will they eat from an iron rice bowl? They'll eat what we can grow and catch. I headed out of the house toward an abandoned sawmill that lay at the end of a dirt road. I walked along an embankment where a railroad track used to run. The path was overgrown with weeds, but other hikers had worn a track through the stalks. I passed a wooden shed where logs had been cut and stacked next to a railroad siding. Some of the logs were still there, but the building had no water tower and no women bathing. Such thoughts, I realized, might bring the wrath of God, but I pictured the bare women anyway. I had a fishing rod in one hand and a creel slung over a shoulder. I walked to the bank of the stream to avoid the underbrush and came to a place where a tree curved under the water. The bowl was easy to stand on. From there, I threw my lure into the water, and the minnow floated quickly downstream. I pulled it back, feeling it wiggling against the current. Mosquitoes flew around me. They were so small I could barely see them. But if one touched my skin, it would bite and inject its saliva. I'd feel a slight stab and scratch the spot, and a white lump would appear. Presently, my brother showed up. I looked at his face to see what was happening at home. Is he still angry? I asked. Yep. We walked out of the undergrowth and into a meadow, looking into the water for fish. Problem was, the fish saw us before we saw them. When we came to slow-moving stretches, we frightened whole schools. They raced away together in a pattern for protection. While I had space to cast a lure, there was nothing to aim for. Oh my God, the trout were gone. On our way home, my brother and I passed the only church in town, a small brick building with a large parking lot for the congregation. Have you ever been inside? My brother asked. No, I said. I was in there once for a Boy Scout meeting. They thought I was going to join, but I didn't go back. At home, I saw that my father was out at the local bar. My Bible's missing, my mother said. I think someone stole it. Who would do that? I asked. A couple of Jehovah's Witnesses came to the door, and I let them in. You know them. One of them is in your class at school. I don't think they took it, I said. My edition has drawings in the margins. It's an illustrated manuscript. On my ride to school, the bus stopped for the boy who was a Jehovah's Witness. When he got in, I asked him if he'd seen a fancy Bible, an illustrated edition. My mother's is missing hers, I said. We have our own Bibles, he said, with our own scriptures. We don't observe pagan holidays like you do. At the beginning of the school day, I stood for the Pledge of Allegiance and recited the words with my hand over my heart, but the Jehovah's Witness stood silently with his arms at his side. In the evening, I felt hot. My skin was itchy from mosquito bites. I started to watch the TV show about the young women who lived at the end of the train line. In this episode, one of them climbed into the locomotive cab and took the throttle and then proceeded to drive the train. I went into the bathroom and lay on the linoleum floor. The hard surface was cool, soothing. I reclined on my back, then switched to my front. Lying on the front of my body was more comfortable. I pressed my skin against the floor. I wasn't like other people. They wouldn't lie on the floor. They probably had nicer floors anyway, made of materials other than linoleum. I rubbed against the hard surface. Soon, an urge overwhelmed me. I had to start scratching. Okay, that's from Thaddeus Rutkowski's Safe Colors. A chapter somewhere in the middle. I guess it's kind of a fictional memoir. I don't know. It just is a novel in short fictions. And I haven't talked to Thaddeus in years. But I saw this was available, and I snagged it. Anybody else out there got a book? Hit me up. I'll read it. Or part of it. Anybody, whether I know you or not. All right, I was going to read another story from that book, but I think I'm going to switch again. We heard from Lucia Berlin. We heard from Thaddeus Rutkowski's book, Safe Colors, on the Meridian Press nonprofit. Now we're going to go into the Wayback Machine and read another dead man. I guess the first one was a dead woman. We'll read a dead man. One of my faves, Marcel Schwab from The King and the Golden Mask. This is called The Plague. The Plague. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show, Good Night, Norman. It is now 12:43 a.m. It says 0:43 on my phone because I have it set to military time. 0:44 a.m. on Monday, the second day of September. Happy New Year. It is a new moon, so. But doesn't September feel like a new year, like after all those years of indoctrination about back to school? It just kind of stays in your, like, somatic memory, like it's September. You're going to, like, meet the new kids. You're going to be the new kid. It's a good time to move, good time to start a new job, good time to fix the way you think. It's just like, it's like the real new year. And nobody even asked anyone to make any resolutions, which is probably why it's better than the other New Year, the fake one in January. All right, enough editorializing. This is The King and the Golden Mask from the book The King and the Golden Mask by Marcel Schwab, also a posthumous publication. This one translated from the French. The name of this story, The Plague. the epigram says to Auguste Breal, I, Buonaccorso, the Neri, the Pitti, son of Buonaccorso, Gonfaloniere of Justice in the Commune of Florenzi, of which the coat of arms was dressed, in the year 1401, by an order of King Rupert in the city of Trento, with the golden rampant lion, want to recount for my ennobled descendants what befell me when I began to roam the land in search of adventure. In the year 1424, I guess that's 600 years ago, right? Being a young man without money, I fled from Florence along the great highways with Matteo for a companion. For the plague was devastating the city. The sickness was swift and attacked in the streets. The eyes burned and grew red, the throat sore, the stomach distended. Then the mouth and tongue were covered by little pockets of irritating water. One was possessed by thirst. A dry cough shook the sick for several hours, and then the limbs went rigid at the joints, the skin piebald with swollen red pox, which some have dubbed buboes. And in the end, the faces of the dead were distended and whitish, with bleeding contusions and mouths open like cornets. The public fountains, nearly dried up from the heat, were surrounded by men hunched and gaunt who tried to dunk their heads. Many plunged straight in. Those were pulled out by chain hook, black with scum, their skulls crushed. The browning corpses littered the middle of the lanes, down which stream in season torrents of rain. The smell was intolerable, and the fear was terrible. But Matteo loved to roll the dice, so we had quite a time there at the exit of the city, and we drank, at the first inn, some mixed wine to our health and mortality. Merchants were there from Genoa and Pavia, and we challenged them with dice cup in hand, and Matteo won 12 ducats. As for me, I invited them to a game of tables, and had the good fortune of walking away with a gain of 20 gold florins, with which ducats and florins we purchased mules and a load of wool. And Matteo, who had deliberated traveling to Prussia, picked up a provision of saffron. We roamed the paths from Padua to Verona. We came back to Padua to furnish ourselves more amply with wool, and we traveled all the way to Venice. From there, passing the sea, we went on into Sclavonia and visited the good cities up to the Croatian border. And Buda, I took sick with fever, and Matteo left me alone at the inn with 12 ducats, returning to Florence, where certain business was calling him and where I was to join him again. I lay in a dry and dusty room on a bag of straw with no doctor but a door that gave on to the drinking room. On St. Martin's night, there arrived a company of fifers and flautists with some 15 or 16 Venetian and Teuton soldiers. After draining many a flask, crushing the pewter steins and breaking the jugs against the wall, they began to dance to the sound of the fife. They peeked their ugly red mugs to the door, and seeing me laid out on my back, started to pull me into the other room, crying, "You drink or you sink!" Then swindled me while the fever pounded on in my head, and finished by dumping me in the sack of straw, the opening of which they stitched shut around my neck. I sweated copiously, and this, no doubt, lowered my temperature, whereas my anger soared. They had tangled up my arms and taken away my bezelar, otherwise I would have made a break for it, thorny with straw, through the soldiers. But on my belt I carried under my stockings a short and sheathed blade. I succeeded in slipping my hand to it, and with its help I slit open the fabric of the sack. Perhaps the fever was still causing my brain to swell, but the memory of the plague we had left in Florence, and which had since spread to Sclavonia, mixed in my mind with a sort of idea I had formed of the face of Sulla, dictator of the Latins, of whom the great Cicero speaks. He resembled, the Athenians said, a blackberry powdered with flour. I resolved to terrify the Venetian and Teuton gendarmes, and when I found myself in the nook where the innkeeper locked up his provisions and the conserved fruits, I quickly slashed a bag full of corn flour. I rubbed my face with this dust, and once I had taken on a complexion neither yellow nor white, with my blade I gave my arm a good scratch, from which I drew enough blood to even unevenly blotch the coating. Then I got back into the sack, and I waited for the drunken reprobates. They came in, laughing and staggering. No sooner had they seen my white and bloody face than they crashed into each other, crying, "The plague! The plague!" Arr! I had even gathered my weapons before the inn was empty. I hadn't even gathered my weapons before the inn was empty. Feeling recovered from the sweat these ruffians had forced on me, I set out on the road for Florence to join back up with Matteo. I found my companion Matteo wandering the Florentine countryside and quite under the weather. He hadn't dared go into the city for the plague that continued to rage there. We turned back and made our way on a quest for riches toward the states of Pope Gregory. Heading up toward Avignon, we encountered bands of armed men carrying lances, pikes, and volgas, for the citizens of Bologna had just risen up against the Pope by request of those of Florence, which we didn't know. We played joyous games of this and that sort with the people there, as many games of tables as of dice, so well that we were upwards of 300 ducats and 40 gold florins. The city of Bologna was almost entirely devoid of people, and we were received in the bathhouses with cries of jubilation. The chambers there are not covered with straw, as in many Lombard cities, and the filthy beds are not lacking there, though the straps are for the most part broken. Matteo ran into a Florentine girl he knew, Mona Giovanna. As for me, who didn't think of asking the name of my girl, I was happy with her. We drank in abundance there of chewy wine from the region and of bitter beer, and we ate jams and tartlets. Matteo, whom I had told of my adventure, feigning to step out, went down into the kitchens and came back disguised as a plague victim. The sauna girls fled on all sides, letting out high-pitched squeals, and then gathered their wits and came still petrified to touch Matteo's face. Mona Giovanni did not want to go back with him and stayed trembling in a corner, claiming his forehead was warm with fever. Meanwhile, Matteo, drunk, lay his head down among the pots right there on the table, which his snores were causing to shake, and he looked like one of those colorful wooden faces street performers show on the sidewalk stage. As we left Bologna, and after divers adventures, we arrived near Avignon, where we learned the Pope was imprisoning all the Florentines and burning them and their books to take vengeance for their rebellion. But we were alerted too late, for the sergeants of the Pope's marshal took us by surprise in the night and threw us in the prison of Avignon. Before our interrogation, we were examined by a judge and provisionally put in the oubliette until the preliminary investigation, with dry bread and water, as is customary in ecclesiastical justice. I nevertheless succeeded in hiding under my robe our burlap sack, which contained a bit of polenta and some olives. The floor of the dungeon was swampy. We had no air, save through a grilled window that opened out to the level of the courtyard grounds. Our feet had been yoked into the holes of very heavy wooden stocks, our hands bound to fairly loose chains, such that our bodies touched from the knee up to the shoulder. The dungeon bailiff did us the kindness of telling us that we were under suspicion of poison, for the Pope had ascertained through certain ambassadors that the Gonfaloniers of the Commune of Florence were entertaining a plot for his death. We were thus in the pitch blackness of the prison, hearing no noise, unsure of the hour of day or night, and in grave danger of being burned alive. I remembered then our strategy, and the idea came to us that the papal justice, by fear of our illness, would have us thrown outside. Painstakingly, I managed to get my polenta, and it was agreed that Matteo would smear his face and blotch it with blood, while I cried out to draw on the lackeys. Matteo made up his mask, and the raspy howls began, as if his throat were constricted. I invoked Our Lady, rattled my chains, but the dungeon was deep, the door thick, and it was night. For several hours we pleaded to no avail. I ceased my cries. Matteo, however, continued to moan. I nudged him with my elbow that he might rest until morning. His moans only grew louder. I touched him in the dark. My hands felt nothing but his belly, which seemed swollen to me like a goatskin, and as he cried in a hoarse voice, a drink, until it seemed I was listening to the desperate calls of a loose dog pack, the pale disk of the rising daylight tumbled in through the little window. Then a cold sweat streamed down my limbs, for under his powdery mask, under the blotches of dried blood, I saw that he was deathly pale, and I recognized the white scabs and the red oozing of the Florentine plague. That was like one of those true bummer stories of olden times. All right, I got about 2 minutes. Not really long enough to read a story. Maybe just long enough, if I can find it. If it's here. Ooh, time's running out. Probably not even here, this stupid. Somebody tell me why in hell I got an Apple phone. Okay. Let's see if this will work. Okay. Local Rebel continues. This poem is called Cats and Dogs. I wrote it today for a couple that's deciding whether or not they want cats and dogs. Cats or dogs, but this is called Cats in Dogs. For my money, their romance remains parallel. Not necessarily an equilibrium, but much the same. All this dander over which season's the home best. All this dander over which season's a home best escapes me. I don't like telling anyone what to do, so cats are my obvious go-to. They don't let you know if they listen, because that's all they do. Furry little spies clocking every move and sound, storing it all in the feline database, sharing it whisker to whisker, not just for now, but later, when you least expect it. Most use it for you, against you. Cats know all.